What's up, everybody? My name is Indy, and that gentleman next to me over there is Mr. Jay Powell from Powell Group Consulting, and welcome to another exciting edition of Jay organizing papers on his desk of Indie Game Business. And today we've got Josh Fairhurst. He is the CEO of Limited Run Games. My gosh. Wow, so right good. Out of my brain. It's been a morning. I just typed it out like 30 seconds ago. And we're talking about why physical games are important in a digital era and much, much more. Podcast hype. Woo! Welcome, Josh. Thanks.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Josh. I've long overdue. I've been trying to get you on here for a while because the last time you and I met, you were working out of the garage, the underground aquarium in the incubator back at the
American Tobacco Campus, the Joystick Labs. Yeah, so that would have been
working on Saturday morning RPG. Years ago. It was a while. So let's start from, tell us how you got into the industry initially, and then walk us through your very interesting career up to this point.
Sure. So I started in the industry officially back in 2008. Prior to that, you know, I had been doing some work with a local community college, building out some curriculums for their game development program. But then in 2008, while I was a junior at NC State in college, I got a job working at Epic as a QA tester on Gears of War 2, which was a lot of work to be a full-time student and also be crunching 90 hours a week on a AAA game. But doing that process kind of gave me an appreciation for how hard it is to make games, and also, you know, started to form my basis of understanding on, you know, where I wanted to go with my career. So working those 90-hour weeks for, you know, a few months that I was there, it really solidified my desire to start my own thing. Because if I was going to work that hard, if I was going to be, you know, basically giving up any kind of free time or life outside of games, I might as well be doing something for myself and building my own business, you know, because I'm going to have to work that hard anyways. So get to the time when I am about to graduate college in 2010, and I get word that there is an incubator in the area that's funding new game studios. And, you know, this was probably the absolute best time that something like that could have happened for me, because I'm about to get out of college and they're funding ideas alone. It's really not a lot of people who are competing for it. So all you need to have is kind of a basic understanding of how to execute and a good enough idea to sell them on. And then you can kind of secure that funding. So I was able to go through that process, secure this small amount of funding to start Mighty Rabbit Studios, which is my development company. The amount of funding they gave me was $20,000, which sounded like a lot to a college student. But then when you actually try to start a business with $20,000, you're like, it's not really that much money. That money did allow us to buy equipment, though, and get licenses to the Unity engine, which we were using at the time. You know, at the time, it was not, you know, a royalty structure. It was, you know, just pay a flat fee and that's it. Simple times. But we managed to get all of that, start working on our first game, which was Saturday Morning RPG. We worked on that game for about 2 years, released it. It ended up being a critical success, but a little bit of a commercial flop. You know, we made a lot of mistakes launching that game. And from there, you know, we did developer work for hire. And then when that started to dry up, we were about to close, go out of business. And that was a scary time. And in that kind of panic, I had this idea for Limited Run Games, which, to introduce everyone, Limited Run Games is a publisher of physical games. These are games on discs or cartridges for collectors and people who still care about actually owning their game in a form that they know they can play and access for decades to come. The reason that I had this idea is, you know, Mighty Rabbit Studios, we had put 5 years of blood, sweat, and tears into these games that we were building. And I didn't want us to go out of business without having one of these games exist in a physical form, just as this kind of living proof that Mighty Rabbit Studios existed. So, you know, our last ditch effort with what little, you know, time we had left, I scrambled to secure a personal loan against every single asset I had. you know, at the worst terms possible. I think I went to Lending Club and just accepted, you know, whatever they would give me. I was already heavily in debt, so I didn't have a good credit score. I just accepted something extremely malicious and bad. And I used that funding to actually do a physical run of the game we had developed, Reach and Clear, for the PlayStation Vita. And anybody at the time would have told you that was a really stupid idea because the Vita had flopped as a console. Nobody was buying the Vita. You know, nobody was developing games for it. And also, you know, digital was kind of king back in 2015. And everyone was saying, like, why would you ever do physical games when you can do digital? There's no cost. There's no overhead. But I wanted a physical copy of my game to exist so that it could have a legacy. Because when you think about old Nintendo games and think about old video games, like, you can remember the bad games because they're still, like, the cartridges are still being traded around. People still remember them. People still talk about them. But when you think about, like, early Xbox Live Arcade 2006, there's, like, hundreds of games nobody talks about anymore. Nobody remembers anymore because, you know, these games just disappeared into the digital ether. There's nobody trading them anymore. There's nobody talking about them. Like, the games might as well have not existed. And these are games that people poured hours or months, years of their life into developing, and they're just poof, gone. And I didn't want our games to kind of succumb to that same fate. So, you know, I against any conventional wisdom, I got a horrible personal loan that could have ruined me, and I made physical copies of this game, and I hoped that they would sell. But even if they didn't, I was kind of just happy and content knowing that everything we put our life into up to that point making would be preserved and people would remember we were here. But what ended up happening is we put this game up for sale, and within 2 hours it had completely sold out. We had gone through every single copy, it was all accounted for, and we had made enough money to keep the doors open. Not enough to pay off my personal loan yet, but enough to keep the doors open. And from there we went on to another release, and bigger developers started reaching out. And since then, it's just been this, you know, whirlwind of, you know, constant upward trajectory. We've just really grown as a company since then. And my development company is still active. Limited Run is, you know, 80 plus employees now. So it's been crazy.
I did not know that was the origin story. I knew that, you know, you wanted to give the physical games a shot. I didn't realize it because you absolutely wanted to make sure that, you know, one of your games lived on in the real world. Yeah. But I mean, it's always, I've always been impressed with how you've pivoted and you've turned everything around and really, for lack of a better phrase, the fuck it, we're going to try this, you know, why not route. So what have you learned so far about the physical game space? Because I agree with you. I mean, at the time, you're right. Everybody would have looked at you and said, you're out of your freaking mind. But the reality is, when everyone else leaves the physical space, there becomes a vacuum and there's something there and there's a space for it. So what have you learned over the last couple of years with regards to how physical games exist in the industry today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that mattered most about doing a game physically to me at the time was that when you sell a physical copy of a game, you're selling it at full price. And I think what was killing a lot of developers back in 2015 and is still killing people now and causing closures is this race to the bottom on digital. You know, like, digital copies, people wait for a Steam sale, they wait to get it in a bundle for pennies on the dollar, and it's like, it's not sustainable for the developer. You know, when we were doing Mighty Rabbit and we were relying on these digital sales of our Saturday morning RPG game, you know, we were putting them in these bundles that were literally selling, like, you get four keys to the game for 25 cents or something. I think that was Indie Gala. It was like, buy one, get three free. And the minimum buy-in was 25 cents. It's like, you know, how are we supposed to sustain on that? Yeah, the 20,000 copies sold, but, like, we made $500. Like, you can't run a company that way. So with physical, there's an inherent value to having a physical copy. Like, you know, you can sell that at full price. People aren't waiting for a sale on that. Maybe they are if it's going to traditional retail and it's, you know, ending up at Walmart and GameStop. But, you know, through our model, direct to consumer, you know, we produce a limited amount of copies, whether that's time limited or quantity limited. And that kind of gives you this assurance, like, the game's not going to go on sale. you know, this is the price for the game. And that's really helpful to developers because it's ensuring that they're getting the value that they should get out of their games. And through doing these physical releases, we've helped a lot of developers actually survive to do their next game, especially early on. You know, we worked with a lot of really small developers, like one person teams or two person teams that were about to go out of business that were kind of in the same position I was. And then doing this physical release for us actually saved their company and allowed them to make their next game. So, you know, I think it's really important to be considering physical in addition to digital, because these physical sales can be a lot more valuable than a bunch of these like really low priced digital sales. You know, like you can make tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of additional dollars that can continue to fund your development through physical releases. And I think a lot of developers are overlooking that right now.
So which platforms do you focus on? One, you mentioned that you're direct to consumer. So you're not selling into Walmart and Best Buy and GameStop anyway.
So we do occasionally, but it's more, you know, on a per title basis where it's like, you know, if our developer partner really wants that, you know, Ninja Turtles, for example, that's a game where we have taken that to traditional retail. Same with Jurassic Park, because these are bigger things that people recognize and know, but we still have that direct to consumer component as well that, you know, drives a lot of upfront initial sales and revenue. The platforms we support, you know, we're kind of on everything right now. You know, we do retro platforms, we do NES, Super Nintendo, Genesis, like older platforms where we allow, you know, our partners who still have software rights to older titles to monetize those. But we also work primarily, our bread and butter is modern platforms, PlayStation 5, Switch, Xbox. Not so much PC because there's not as much of a physical market there. You know, we do big box releases every now and then, but the only ones that really sell are things that have ties to PC lineage, like Doom related stuff or Command and Conquer or, you know, adventure games, point and click stuff. So, you know, it's very specific and focused what you can do physically on PC. But, you know, we've released a wide breadth of stuff for consoles because, you know, there is a very big physical appetite there.
How do you even go about releasing something for the SNES or the original Nintendo system these days?
So it's a matter of just, you know, having the right suppliers. You know, we work with a company called Retrobit. They design new PCBs that actually, you know, function with the old systems. So, you know, we can supply a ROM file that, you know, our process for getting the game software is we'll buy an older copy of the game. Take the cartridge, put it on this board we have that will then dump the ROM file to our PC. And then from there, you know, we'll make any modifications in the ROM that our partner needs and then send that ROM off to be manufactured by our partner at Retrobit. You know, they work with members of the retro gaming community to build kind of the best, highest quality PCBs, chipboards for, you know, these retro systems that kind of conform to all of the previous standards and high quality that the platform holders themselves had for those carts.
I love the way you make that sound so easy. Okay, we just get a little copy and we just dump it down and then we send it up to be manufactured. But that is very cool.
There's a lot more steps in there, but you know.
But yeah, I mean, that's the gist of it. But I mean, yeah, that is actually, that's very, very cool, Josh. So what do you all look for? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of indie teams out there who have had, you know, much like Saturday Morning RPG, critical success, financial, not so much. What do you look for? How do you go about, you know, deciding what you're going to publish?
Yeah, so for us, it's really a matter of looking for social proof and evidence that there's demand for, you know, physical copies of these things. Sometimes it's a matter of like, it's just something we really want to personally do, whether it's, you know, a member of my team really loves this particular game and wants to release it, or, you know, it's an IP that really matters to me. Like there's a bunch of old Star Wars games we re-released and it's because I'm a big Star Wars nerd. So it's like, of course I'm going to do those. But, you know, when it comes to like assessing games that are coming out, we tend to look at, you know, how often people are talking about this game on social media, how, you know, much we see in terms of press coverage, what the critical reviews look like, and then, you know, how it's been received on Steam, which is, you know, fairly transparent through the Steam reviews. You know, if a game's got a couple hundred reviews, very positive or overwhelmingly positive, you know, that's a sign of quality and a sign that, you know, that's something we can probably throw our hat behind.
So are you typically going to the publisher of these games, or are you dealing directly with the developers? How do you...
It's a mixture. So sometimes, you know, we'll have developers or partners come to us and say, hey, we've got these games, or we're wondering if they're of interest to you. We're looking for a physical avenue. And then on the flip side of that is us kind of seeking out games actively that we would like to release. So in those situations, it's mostly me or JP, who does a lot of our business development, reaching out to the developer saying, hey, you know, this particular game really interests us. We do physical publishing. Here's a brief on us, and here's what we think we can do for you. So we'll tend to send out some like revenue estimates up front to show them like, hey, you'll actually make money. Because typically with retail and physical, you know, at least, you know, before we started, when it was focused on big box retailers, it was always very much in the favor of the distributors, the middlemen who were getting between the developer and that final product on the shelf at Walmart. And a lot of people in 2015 were looking at physical releases as, oh, this is marketing. Shelf presence is going to push the digital product. And we kind of flipped that on its head and came up with a way to do physical and actually make it make money. Because when you go direct to consumer, you're cutting all those middlemen out. So a lot of the time we have to prove people who are familiar with how little you used to make, show them like, hey, we can actually make money here. We can actually generate profit for you on this.
So how many games do y'all usually do a year, Josh?
Probably about 200 or so. So in our 8 years, we've done over 1,000 different game releases, and it's kind of gotten more, you know, I would say we do about 2 game releases a week. So, you know, SKU count ends up being about 200. So I'm getting a little scrambled there, but raw game count is probably somewhere around that, like 100 games.
How in God's, that is a huge load of games for a publisher, even for a huge publisher. How do you manage all of that?
It's a lot of just trying to keep our heads above water, just in terms of communication. You know, we do our best. But a lot of the time it's driven a lot by passion. So, you know, we really, really like a lot of games and we want to be able to release these games. So, you know, the passion kind of helps us stay on top of things and keep our drive to push things along and to push things through. It's been difficult kind of learning the processes to make sure that we can handle this volume. And that's something, you know, I think we finally just recently got our hands around. But it's exciting from my perspective because, you know, we're really working on something new every day. So it never gets boring. It never gets rote or mundane. You know, there's always something new and something fun and exciting to work on.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around doing that many games a year because that is just absolutely insane. And congratulations on doing it is absolutely a lot. Now, are you doing any new stuff or is it all back catalog, you know, games that have already been released that you have that
proof? We work with partners on new stuff as well. You know, we also have kind of a mixed model where it's like sometimes, you know, we'll just do a collector's edition for a major release. Like we worked with EA. We did a collector's edition for Jedi Fallen Order. We did a CE for Dead Space. So, you know, in those cases, those were brand new games that were coming out that, you know, we just kind of provided this collector's edition component to where we created a very elaborate, nice SKU for the fans. We do occasionally kind of try to do simultaneous launches with newer games, like trying to think of a recent example where we've done a simultaneous launch, but I'm drawing a blank just because we do so much. But, you know, we were very close to the launch of Ninja Turtles, Shredder's Revenge, for instance. You know, we launched our digital product or our physical product maybe a month after the digital launch. And in that case, you know, that was a newer title that had just come out. So, you know, we're kind of doing a mix of new games, old games, really anything that needs a physical component.
I'm diving back into my days of having to deal with physical games too. And I mean, so how close can you realistically get? Because what a lot of people probably don't realize is digital is one thing. You finalize your digital game, you upload it, give it a couple of days maybe, and you're launching. Physical is not the same way. You've got to send that. You know, you're working back in the days where you literally still had a gold master to send out to somebody. How long does that process take these days?
And it kind of, this kind of comes down to our development partners, you know, their preference. Do they want to actually have that physical product in hand alongside their digital release? Because if that's the case, you know, we typically need about, you know, it depends on if you're going to retail. If this is a game where they want to be on retail shelves alongside their digital game, you're talking 5 months for that, because you have from, you know, they have to have an approved build with the platform holders 5 months ahead of launch. So we can manufacture the product, which takes about 2.5 to 3 months. And then we actually need a month to distribute it to retailers. And then they need a month to actually warehouse it, inventory it, distribute it to their stores, and ensure that it gets shelf placement. So, you know, that's the furthest timeline from launch. If we're just, since we're direct to consumer, thankfully we can shave some time off that. If our partner just wants to have it in hand in time for the digital launch and we're shipping out simultaneously, we can start manufacturing around usually 2.5 to 3 months ahead of that digital launch. So it requires planning from our partner. And that's really why, like, we only do this if it's something they want. We don't push for it because we don't really see a noticeable impact in sales. Typically what we do is we put things up for pre-order for 4 to 6 weeks and we manufacture to demand. So whatever amount of units sell during that pre-order period, we make. So we can really approach physical at any point after that digital launch. And that tends to be what our partners prefer because it gives them all the flexibility of that digital launch where it's like, upload it, get it approved, and within a week or two, you're launching. They still want to have that, not have to worry about gold master candidates and all these nonsense things that come up with trying to sim ship digital and physical.
Yeah, for those of you younger folks in the industry who wonder why November and December are generally more dead in the industry, that's because 15, 20 years ago, they were literally dead. If you didn't have all your shit to Walmart by October 1, you weren't doing anything anyway. And so there was nothing to do during those months. But it almost seems like, I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense. It almost seems like that process now takes longer than it used to. But if all of these companies aren't doing as much of it as they did 15, 20 years ago, I can see why it would take longer to go to market.
It's a deprioritization. Yeah. You know, there's fewer people working on the physical side, both in terms of manufacturing and at the retailers receiving the product and distributing the product. You know, it's just not as much of a priority as it used to be. So there's a lot more time that it can take. And with Switch particularly, that's really what adds a lot of time to that process. You know, manufacturing PlayStation discs, that can take a month. But manufacturing Switch cartridges, they're all manufactured in Japan, and then the cartridges have to come overseas. Then they have to go to a Nintendo-approved print facility and assembly facility where that facility has to schedule time on the actual assembly line to put the product together, box it out, and then ship it to us. So there's all this extra time for transportation on Switch products that just balloons the amount of time you need ahead of, you know, any planned retail launch.
Nintendo has always been the problem. That's when it comes to delays and everything. Because you still have to buy all the cartridges straight from Nintendo and that kind of wonderful stuff as well.
So it all comes straight from NCL in Japan. And then it has to fly over, pass through customs, end up transporting to your packout facility. And then, again, they have to schedule you. So if they're already busy with something else, you could end up 2-3 weeks from when the carts arrive to when they actually pack them out. So, you know, it can be quite a lengthy process for Switch. That 2.5 to 3 months is, vast majority of that's going to be Switch. Because Xbox product and PlayStation product, it's all discs.
It's
quick, unless you've got something like a Grand Theft Auto 6 or something on the line and it's basically claimed that line for 3 weeks because they're making a million copies, which is an anomaly and doesn't really happen. That's the only thing that would ever introduce like a delay in the process.
So you had to learn all of this stuff just by doing it when you started Limited Run, or did you go out and find all the, you know, old folks like me and Larry that had to deal with this years ago and hire them to bring you up to speed on doing physical?
No, it's just learn as I go. You know, just figure it out. And there was a lot of things that kind of had to be put in place for this, because at least up front, the MOQs with Sony were a lot higher than they are now. And I had to get them to kind of acquiesce to lower MOQs to make these things happen. And that was a bit of a process, because I was simultaneously convincing them they should do this so we can do it, and while learning the whole process, which was a wait. And when they let us start doing this, I don't think they understood the amount of volume that this would then bring in on the physical side. So they didn't have a lot of processes in place for taking a product from digital to physical. So they had to start inventing new processes for that. So a lot of things have kind of changed to accommodate our model. And that kind of came up through me just trying to figure this out and learn it as I was going along.
All right. Explain to folks what an MOQ is.
So that's a minimum order quantity. So sorry, I'm using industry jargon here, but the minimum order quantity determines, you know, how many you can order. It's like one platform holder may say, you got to order 10,000 units of this, or we won't manufacture it at all. And that was the kind of stuff that we had to work to get lower. On Xbox, it took us forever to get on that platform because their MOQ had historically been the highest. And we really had to work that down to the point where now it's matching Sony, which is on the lower end of the order requirement. But those minimum order quantities are typically the reason why an indie developer couldn't just go and produce a physical game themselves. Because, you know, if there was no minimum order quantity, somebody could probably just go order 100 units. And sure, they'd be able to sell those easy enough, but it's a different problem when you have to order 2,000 and then figure out, where am I going to store these? How am I going to sell them? And whatever. It increases that barrier of entry, which is what we really hope to step in and solve, is make it easier for smaller developers and publishers who don't want to deal with this headache to actually get over, because we can sell them direct to consumer. We have our own warehouse. We have our own fulfillment. We have all this stuff set up to make it turnkey for our partners.
So what should indie devs be looking at if long-term plan, they want to ensure or at least shoot for a physical release of their game? What do they need to keep in mind through the development process up to launch?
So there's not really a whole lot outside of, you know, you've got to have the value there. So if you're selling your game digitally for like $4.99, it's going to be really hard to get anybody on board to do a physical release for that, because there's also the costs associated with physical. If it costs more to press the disc than your game sells for digitally, it's going to be very hard to convince consumers to pay the necessary price for it in physical form. Because in order to make any money on physical, you got to sell that product for $30, $35. So if you've got a $5 digital game, probably not going to suit a digital launch. So if you're thinking about physical, you need to think about creating something that can sustain a $15 price tag digitally, at least, in order to justify that physical markup that's going to have to happen to account for the production costs. And that's really the only thing you have to consider, because these days games don't actually run from the media. Back in the PlayStation 3, Xbox 360 days and prior, you know, the games were actually running off the discs. So you had all sorts of technical issues you had to accommodate and think about. But now it's just, you put in the physical media, it installs it, and then it just runs like a digital game. So it's super duper easy from the dev side to support physical. The only thing you really have to think about is the price tag of your experience and the length of it. Because if you're building like a quick action, 1 minute arcade style game that's going to cost $5, it probably can't sustain a physical or cartridge release.
So, I mean, are the retailers, I think they used to not allow this. Are the retailers okay for, you know, selling a $30 product in the store and $15 digitally, or does that really only apply to stuff you're doing direct?
So we have found that the retailers are accommodating now, just because there's not a lot of competition. I mean, there's not a lot of product coming through. So it's kind of like, if we say this is what this costs, you know, you either stock it or you don't, because we're going direct to consumer and we don't care if you stock it. It kind of took the power off them to be able to say,
how the tables have turned.
Yeah. they can't really say what the price is, because nobody relies on them. Nobody's like, we're saying direct to consumers are bread and butter. Retail's just additive. So, you know, you either play with our pricing or, you know, we don't care. I think that's been a powerful thing here. So I've noticed that at this point, a lot of publishers actually are doing releases of cheaper digital games at higher physical prices, and it has been more accepted both by consumers and retailers. You know, at least on the consumer side, there is an understanding that physical brings value, especially with content starting to disappear from like streaming services and digital platforms. People understand, like, if I own this on a disc, I actually own it. Versus digital, you don't actually own anything. You have a license that can be revoked at any time. So people are like, I'll pay a little extra to actually know that I get to keep this thing.
It is for everyone else, your entire livelihood as a developer, publisher, or distributor used to hinge on whether or not that buyer, who probably was not a gamer from you know, GameStop or Best Buy or Target or Walmart or whoever, whether they liked your game. And they had all the power. And so to see that be completely flipped on its head, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's it's not so much a problem anymore. You know, we get to call the shots.
That's fantastic. Nicely done, Josh. So if you've got questions about physical releases, limited run games, whatever, drop them in chat wherever you are, or drop them in the Discord and we'll get to them live. So in and amongst all this, you said Mighty Rabbit's still alive. So what's Mighty Rabbit up to?
Yeah, so Mighty Rabbit Studios, especially, so limited run games back in 2022 in August, we actually sold to Embracer. And, you know, I know Embracer is not super popular right now, but they've been good to us. We are a very cash positive business, so we were kind of safe from the restructuring and all the stuff that was happening. But as part of my deal when Embracer bought Limited Run, I'm focused on Limited Run now. And my original co-founder for Mighty Rabbit, who had left for a while, actually, I brought him back in to come back to Mighty Rabbit. So he is now managing Mighty Rabbit, and they're actively developing new products. But in kind of that interim period where I was focused on Limited Run up to the acquisition by Embracer, Mighty Rabbit was really focused on kind of being a contractor with Microsoft. So we were doing a lot of first party products for In Exile. We worked on Bard's Tale 4, Wasteland 3, and the Clockwork Revolution, which I think is the name of the new one. I always forget the new title. But Mighty Rabbit provided a lot of extra support on that in terms of programmers and artists. And now with my co-founder back, Nick, managing Mighty Rabbit, he is getting prepared to launch a new game called Cylinder, which is a kind of multiplayer puzzle game that's going to come out on Steam with online multiplayer.
So are you going to be self-publishing that, or are you running the traditional route through a publisher?
So Mighty Rabbit Studios is self-publishing that title. That was more of an exercise for them in learning whether they could do it. And kind of learning the submission processes for the various platforms. So, you know, I don't think they're expecting it to be a big runaway hit or anything. It was more like, you know, let's learn the ropes of submitting a smaller project and doing all of this stuff because we haven't done it in a while, and kind of figure out how to do it. So on our next bigger project, we're kind of more well-versed and prepared for how we get this thing submitted and, you know, what we're going to need to do on the developer side. Whether that game ends up being published through a publisher or not.
And that's exactly why, you know, we always advise newer teams not to try to come out of the gate with something huge for exactly the reason you just said. Do something smaller, use it as an exercise in, can we do this? Do we know what we're doing? Let's learn. And, you know, if something goes wrong, it's not, you know, the absolute end of the world.
Exactly.
But yeah, to figure out all the processes and get it done. All right, we've got a question from Discord from HiClam. What kind of budget should an indie studio expect to pay to see a game go physical? Are you who we should go to, or would you recommend others doing similar stuff?
So the way that everyone's been doing it since we kind of revolutionized the model is we don't actually make our partners pay anything for the physical release. We finance all of it. You know, all the risk falls on us. And that's really how all of our competitors in the space do it as well. And what's great is we're not the only company doing this right now. You know, you can go to a variety of other people that are offering similar services. So what I would recommend doing is you can feel free to reach out to us. If your game's not a fit for us, you then have all these other options that you can also look into. A lot of them are in Europe, like Red Art games, super rare games, strictly limited games. You know, there's a huge list at this point of people that kind of got into this after we started doing it. I would say that we are the premier. So we were here in 2015 before anybody else was. And we have a much larger customer base than anybody else. So we're more competitive in that regard. But not every game's going to be a fit because there are hundreds of games out there every month. And we can only publish so many. And that's kind of why I don't really consider everybody competition, because there's enough games to go around for everyone. And I would say the same thing to developers as well. Don't get discouraged if it's not a fit for us, because it could be a fit for one of these other 15, 20 physical publishers that are out there doing a similar model.
I love the fact that you said there's only so many games we can do and you're dropping 200 games a year. It's like that's
yeah,
we can only do.
That's still such a small fraction of the total games that are coming out these days. So it's kind of amazing to think of it that way, because you know, if we were doing 100 games back in the 90s, we'd probably be cornering the market. I mean, that's about how much was coming out any given year across all the platforms. So it's kind of amazing to think now that we've got, you know, 10, 15,000 games a year launching, maybe more. I can't remember what the last statistic was.
I want to say there was 14,000 was one of the numbers I saw on Steam for any particular period, but that's just like, that's just Steam. What,
that's crazy. I mean,
are you all looking to actually finance any development, or should developers that want to do this already have a game that's finished?
So we typically look for games that are finished. We do fund some things. You know, we have started to get into that more recently, but we're funding very specific things. Like, we're trying to build more of a brand identity, like a Devolver, you know, or an Annapurna, where they have these brand identities, specific games fit their lineup. And that's really what we're focused on now. So we're kind of looking at, like, you know, really left field things. Like, you say it, it's a very easy pitch. You say it, and then people are like, Why would that exist? Like, we did a remaster of Plumbers Don't Wear Ties, the worst game of all time. That's an example of a left field game where it's like nobody on earth would ever think to fund that. That's the kind of stuff we like to do. We also did a spiritual successor to the Zelda CDI games, which are kind of notoriously mocked. And that game was called Arzette, and that's out on Steam now and was very successful. And I think that right now in the crowded market, you need a really strong hook. And to me, there's no hook stronger than making people ask, why would that exist? So that's kind of our focus. Outside of that, we're kind of mainly interested in reviving retro classics. We have internal tech. We developed an emulation engine called Carbon Engine that allows us to revive a lot of older classic games from PS1 and prior and bring them to Switch, PlayStation, Xbox, PC. So we've been focused on that. And then our third pillar of what we're looking for is like licensed stuff, you know, things that are based on IPs that excite us. So, you know, Shredder's Revenge, we're not publishing that, but that's kind of an example of what we're looking for. Things that really understand the IP, really good games. So not the 2000s era of licensed games where it's just like, or prior where, you know, you get a license and slap it into something marginally or tangentially related to that license. We're talking about a smarter approach, like licensed games that really truly deliver what fans of that IP want. So those are kind of the three things we're funding, but we do typically focus on smaller budgets, you know, something around the $500,000 and less arena. So, you know, we're not really funding multi-million dollar productions here. We kind of leave that to people who know digital publishing better than we do.
Walk me through the process of all of y'all sitting down in a meeting one day and deciding to do remasters and spiritual successors to some of the worst games of all time.
Yeah.
And so, why you thought that was going to be a success, and then how did you make it a success?
Yeah, so we had one of our early successes at Limited Run was re-releasing Night Trap, a Sega CD game that was kind of notoriously known for not being very great. It was constantly ranked on worst games of all time list, but
that had Dana Plato in it. I remember playing that game when it originally really came out.
So we went into it thinking, oh, it's not going to be that big of a success. You know, it's on all these worst games of all time lists. It's probably not going to sell very well. Let's only do, you know, a small number of copies. We put the game up for sale and it sold out in like 30 seconds. And then we got death threats for like 3 weeks following that launch from people who were mad that they couldn't get it. And it's like, you know, that was kind of proof positive that, you know, there's a strength in both the best games and the worst games. You know, like, we're never going to be able to re-release Ocarina of Time, you know, the best game of all time, consistently ranked in top tens. But we can re-release Plumbers Don't Wear Ties. And it's just as well known and notable, perhaps for, obviously for completely different reasons. But, you know, that notoriety creates a morbid curiosity that people will have in checking that out. They're like, okay, I have to see what this game is about. If it's consistently considered the worst game of all time, I want to check it out. I want to know why it's bad. And that was kind of the logic going into that one. It's like, people want to see why this game is so bad. You know, they know it's going to be bad. They're willingly subjecting themselves to it. And I think that's just human nature. People want to see train wrecks.
I can just see a meeting, you know, putting the sales numbers up for Night Trap, and then one of you looking around and going, okay, all right, look, they bought Night Trap. There's no way they're going to buy this next one we're going to come up with.
That is kind of somehow it is also just kind of fun from my perspective, seeing how these things play out, because to me, it's fun to do the things that nobody else expects, because then you announce it and you see all these responses of people saying, this is insane. This is stupid. Why would they ever do this? And then it's just fun to defy those odds, because Plumbers Don't Wear Ties ended up being like a 50 times return on our investment. So it was kind of a really good proof that this approach works. And that doesn't mean we're going to strictly re-release bad games, but it's fun to do every once in a while because nobody else is going to do it.
So is E.T. on the list, the original one?
We did actually try that because we work with Universal a lot, and that's one of their IPs. But Steven Spielberg doesn't want to revisit E.T. You know, probably obvious reasons. He, you know, because he has a say in anything that's an Amblin property. And, you know, obviously he wants to respect those properties. Our approach to E.T. would have been to go back to the original programmer and kind of give him the time that he needed to make that game, because it's well known that the reason it's not the best game is it was made in 3 weeks.
Yeah,
there was a lot of good ideas that could not be executed in 3 weeks' time. But imagine if he got to revisit that game got a redemption arc. There's something that is fascinating about that in my mind, giving a game that everyone knows is bad a redemption arc to show, like, hey, it actually wasn't bad. It was just the fact that it was made in 3 weeks that made it bad.
How long do you think it went? I mean, because we're talking about the original Atari here. We're not looking at something that's a technological masterpiece these days. How long do you think it would take to create that magnum opus of an E.T. Atari game if they have more than 3 weeks?
I mean, I think that would come down to the programmer himself, because one of the things that I have noted working with a lot of people is that, you know, if you kind of don't put time limits on it, they can work on it forever and continuously make it better. But I don't think it would take super long. I think it would take maybe a couple months of focus.
I was just curious, you know, because you're not dealing with nearly the design complexity that you have.
No.
So
it would still be one. It would still be one person kind of, you know, going on it. Desert Bus actually got a VR update. So Gearbox released Desert Bus for VR on Steam, and I had no idea about this. I had no idea about that. I was like, this got no fanfare. I think they just kind of quietly put it up on Steam, and, you know, nobody talked about it, which I thought was absurd, because I was like, I feel like I should have heard about this, but I only heard about it upon research. But it exists. It's up there.
Huh. All right. So from Joshua on YouTube, do you see companies behind consoles pulling support for physical media at some point in the future?
So I do. I think that, you know, we're going to see over the next decade, we're probably going to see Microsoft exit physical media first. I think everyone expected that when they announced initially all of that stuff with the Xbox One, you know, back in 2014, there was that initial strategy with physical media where, like, the discs were basically just going to be little, licenses or whatever, one-time installs. I don't remember the specifics back then, but I think Xbox fans are kind of by and large more digitally inclined. And I think Sony will follow after that. You know, I don't think it's going to be the PS6 generation, but maybe the one after that where Sony goes, yeah, we're going to go all digital with this. I think that the PS5 having that removable disk drive is kind of evidence that they are kind of playing around with this mindset. But I think Nintendo is going to just cling to physical media for decades. I don't know how many generations it's going to be before Nintendo goes all digital, because if you look at sales on first party software for Nintendo, it's still like more than 80% is physical. And I don't think that they would suddenly say, let's disrupt that and go digital. So I think from my perspective, we're fairly safe in terms of at least being able to continue to focus on Nintendo. But if we reach a point where optical media is dead and no platforms support it, you know, we've got some backup plans that we're thinking about.
I agree. It's like if anyone is going to stick to it long term, it's going to be Nintendo, just because that's what they've always done. But yeah, it is interesting to
they don't tend to follow anybody else.
No, they
kind of play by their own rules.
But it's interesting that you're thinking two more generations out before Microsoft and Sony decide to pull the plug on it, though.
I mean, I think Microsoft might be faster. I think Microsoft might be next generation. I think Sony is going to maybe give it one more generation and then go, okay. I think they're going to let Microsoft take the plunge and get the hate first.
Well, they already did that once with Xbox One.
It worked out. PS4 ended up outselling it dramatically. So, you know, I feel like that's always been the Sony strategy, is let somebody else screw up first so that we can look better. You know, that's what they did with the PS1 and the Sega Saturn. Sega Saturn got announced, and then they came out and they're like, ours is cheaper, it's going to have better games. You know, it's always being second to jump in. You get to fix all the mistakes that everybody else made before you. So I think that's going to be what happens with the next Sony generation. Microsoft will take the plunge, say, we're focused on Game Pass and streaming and whatever else, like no more discs. And then Sony will be, let's see how it goes for Microsoft, and then we'll dip our toes in the pool right after that.
So where do you see the market? Because you bring up Saturn, I immediately start thinking of like, why aren't people doing, you know, retro consoles themselves? We know Atari tried. Did that thing, I don't know if that thing ever came out or not, but where do you see that sort of the market going between companies releasing, whether it's you all, if you get into that route, releasing like a new Super Nintendo, or all of these like digital arcade machines that you can get at Walmart and everything else now? Where do you see that market fitting in?
So I think that if you look at the retro gaming hardware market, people are already starting to build new enthusiast level hardware for these retro platforms. So big company in the space, Analog, they make, you know, a Super Nintendo that's, I think $300 maybe. I'm trying to remember the pricing for it. They also made this Game Boy device, the Analog Pocket. And this thing is a $250 device. It plays, you know, original Game Boy games, but in a better visual quality than you would have gotten playing them back in the 90s. And that's kind of where I see that kind of hardware going, focused on the adult collectors and people that are still playing them. So they're more expensive, high-end machinery, kind of like, you know, high-end stereos or whatever for audiophiles. So I think they'll continue to be support on that front. Like, there's always going to be people that want physical media. And even if, you know, in 8 years, we don't have a physical PlayStation or physical Xbox anymore, I think what's going to happen is we're going to get 10 more years out from that, and consumers are going to start saying, we want physical again, just like we saw with vinyl records and music. There was about 10 years or whatever where everyone was like nuts about digital and streaming. And I think maybe it was 2 years ago or something, vinyl accounted for like one of the largest portions of music sales for artists. And that's kind of evidence that people want physicality, and they're always going to want physicality. At some point, the novelty and convenience of digital is outweighed by the fact that people realize they don't own anything.
In my head, I just see an arcade cabinet with an old like 12 disc changer in it that you can, you know, just load up 12 games and flip them from one to another. All right. Question from YouTube. Are there any specific game genres that are clearly more popular on certain platforms that you release for?
Yeah, so I mean, for us particularly, the things that end up being the most popular are things with kind of ties back to retro nostalgia. So retro-inspired games that, you know, play into the kind of nostalgia that people in that physical collecting demographic would like. So I would say our demographic tends to skew far more towards people in their 30s to 50s. But that said, there are a lot of younger people that care about physical media. So we do have a lot of people who are 18, 20, you know, whatever, that are buying physical products. But our core demographic, that 30 to 50, like, they love experiences that kind of remind them of the things that they used to play in the 80s or 90s and early 2000s, you know, things that kind of harken back to a simpler era, for lack of a better way to describe it.
Plugging two Game Boys together with a link cable at lunch in the, you know, lunchroom so you can play Tetris against your buddies. That's awesome. Josh, you have one of the biggest success stories, I feel, in the industry, you know, going from, you know, an indie developer and then turning around and pivoting into Limited Run. And you deserve all the credit and success that goes along with that, man. I
thank you.
Very, very, very happy to see your success. Are there any things that you want to plug? Anything coming up that, you know, exciting for you all that you want everybody to know about?
So we were doing a physical release of one of my favorite Ubisoft titles of all time, Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon. And I'm really excited about that because it's my favorite Far Cry game. And honestly, I think in terms of theming, it's just one of the coolest games that's been made. So I was really excited to be involved with it. And hopefully a lot of people turn up for it because I have so much enthusiasm for that release. And I just, you know, I hope people come and, you know, are appreciative of, you know, the love and care that we put into what we created for it.
Man, you really never did get out of the 80s, did you?
No. No, I love the aesthetic of that game. It's so, yeah. It's so nice.
That is awesome. All right, man. Dan?
Yeah, here we are.
That, you know what? That's my favorite Far Cry game, too, is Blood Dragon. It's good.
Nice. Yeah, it's great.
It's different. It's good. Thank you so much, Josh, for coming on here. We appreciate you much. Check out Limited Run Games. I remembered it that time. See that? Go ahead, Jay. I know you're going to say something.
No. I was just
you were going to say something. I'm good. Also, check out our Discord, y'all. Discord.gg/indiegamebusiness. And also, if you're watching, there's a link that is scrolling across the bottom of the screen right now. It's a link tree/indiegamebusiness. Everybody on Discord, you can look at all of our links there as well. Linktree/indiegamebusiness. And go ahead and check out indiegamebusiness.com. Sign up for the newsletter. And you get a bunch of cool stuff with the newsletter. You get the publisher list and the investor list. And that's amazing. All from the Powell Group. We're sponsored by the Powell Group right there. It's that logo right there, which that's this guy over there. Yeah. Thank you so much, Josh, for coming on.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work, man. You're doing a wonderful service for the industry in general.
Appreciate it.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Next week.